Okay, are we ready? I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
The Festival International Nuit d'Afrique invites you to its 37th edition in Montreal from July 11th to 23rd for a worldwide musical journey. Hundreds of artists from Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America will entertain you with more than 150 concerts and activities for the whole family. Enjoy this festive and unique event rich in discoveries. Don't miss Bik Bazé from Cameroon, the famous Kora Knight with Sekou Keita and Zal Sissoko, or Saïd Meznaoui and Trans Nawa Fusion, and much more. Visit festivalnuitdafrique.com for the complete program.
Fondation Fabienne Nicolas et le groupe Banque TD vous invitent au 17e festival Haïti en folie du 24 au 30 juillet avec projection du film Freda de Jessica Généus, gastronomie, artisanat, littérature, spectacle gratuit d'Emeline Michel, Admiral T, B.I.C, Wesley, Wally, Bass Compa, défilé Rara et plus de 150 artistes. Aïe, aïe, aïe! Haïti comme vous ne l'avez encore jamais vu du 24 au 30 juillet au quartier des spectacles, Parc La Fontaine et Théâtre Outremont. Infos et billets haitienfolie.com. Supporté par Conseil des arts du Canada, patrimoine canadien, SAQ, Tourisme Québec, Ville de Montréal et Tourisme Montréal.
7e Festival Haïti en folie vous invite au défilé Rara. Haïti en folie dans les rues de Montréal avec le groupe Rara Jazz, Rara Indigène et les danseuses d'Haïti Makaya ce samedi 29 juillet dès 16h. Départ au Parc des Compagnons, coin Montréal et quartier. Aïe, aïe, aïe. Rara dans Montréal, nous tournons, pirates, vinaigre drapeau nous, costume nous, samedi 29 juillet, depuis 4 heures. Une initiative de la Fondation Fabienne Cola. Info, haitienfolie.com.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates' family and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaweetsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadi, Wendin Naganag. How Mataki was. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people. We're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tanse, how? Wuju anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say, Ninanaskamun Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Ninanaskamutaman Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski. Hi, hi. Thank you.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
This is Democracy Now!
When the separation of families at the border here happened in 2017 and 18, I remember the kinder transport and other instances in which the children have been taken away from the parents. For example, during slavery, children were sold out, taken from their mother's arms.
The Wind Knows My Name. That's the title of the new novel by acclaimed author Isabel Allende, which looks at the trauma of child family separation from the Nazi Holocaust to the U.S.-Mexican border. She joins us today. But first, we speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa on a new investigation into the sexual abuse of women detained by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian ongoing attacks on Ukrainian grain supplies have destroyed at least 60,000 tons of grain as global food security faces mounting threats. Russia's navy's also carried out live-fire military exercises in the Black Sea days after Moscow withdrew from the Black Sea grain deal, and both Moscow and Kyiv said ships traveling to either Russian or Ukrainian ports through the waterway constitute potential military targets. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said today he'll be holding talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, which could lead to restoring the grain deal. Meanwhile, Ukraine started using cluster bombs supplied by the United States on the battlefield. Over 100 countries have signed on to an international treaty banning their use due to the danger they pose to civilians, though it's not signed by Russia, Ukraine, or the United States. In Nebraska, the teenager who used abortion pills to terminate her pregnancy was sentenced to 90 days in jail. Police charged 19-year-old Celeste Burgess and her mother, Jessica Burgess, who assisted her in getting the pills and disposing of the fetus, after Facebook handed over their private messages. Celeste was just 17 when her mother ordered the pills online. The events took place before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June 2022. At the time, abortion in Nebraska was banned after 20 weeks. Earlier this year, Governor Jim Pillen signed a 12-week ban into law. Meanwhile, a court in Austin heard testimony this week from women who are suing over Texas's abortion ban, which puts their lives in danger when they were unable to end their pregnancies, even when they were non-viable. In a dramatic moment, plaintiff Samantha Cassiano vomited on the stand as she recounted her traumatic experience. She was forced to carry out her pregnancy even after receiving a diagnosis of anencephaly, a severe congenital disorder that results in a baby being born without portions of its brain and skull. Another plaintiff, Elizabeth Weller, spoke at a news conference Wednesday.
I was sent home to wait for my baby to die or for my infection to start showing physical symptoms, even though they were already there. But I wasn't sick enough to get the care that I needed. There is no statement of pro-life in this state when you send me home to wait for my baby to die inside of me and for me to wait for myself to get to a point where I have to gamble my uterus and gamble my life and gamble any future possibility of becoming pregnant. That's not pro-life. In a sense, it's almost pro-torture.
The press conference was held by the Center for Reproductive Rights, which brought the lawsuit on behalf of 13 patients and two doctors. In related news, new data shows Texas's abortion bans likely leading to a surge in infant mortality as women are forced to carry non-viable pregnancies to term. Infant deaths increased by over 11% last year over the previous year. Meanwhile, infant deaths with severe genetic and birth defects rose by over 21% after years of decline. Florida's Board of Education approved new standards for teaching Black history after Governor Ron DeSantis and Florida Republicans passed new laws limiting what can be taught in classrooms as part of their anti-woke crusade. The standards include teaching children that, quote, slaves develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit, unquote. It also instructs educators to teach about violence committed by Black people. The Florida Education Association blasted the new standards, saying, quote, Governor DeSantis is pursuing a political agenda guaranteed to set good people against one another, and in the process, he's cheating our kids. They deserve the full truth of American history, the good and the bad, they said. Vice President Kamala Harris is traveling to Jacksonville today to speak out against Florida's attack on Black history and education. In more news from Florida, rights groups are suing over SB 1718, a new law targeting immigrants, making it more difficult to work and get medical care, among other things. One in five Florida residents is an immigrant. In a statement, the ACLU of Florida said, quote, this legislation is not the solution to any problem. It's an attempt to scapegoat and terrorize vulnerable families and workers already burdened by the difficulty of the federal immigration process, they said. Meanwhile, the Florida Rights Restoration Committee is suing DeSantis, they say, for illegally intimidating people with felonies in order to prevent them from voting. The lawsuit accuses Florida of creating intentional obstacles to determine voting eligibility and creating an election police to go after people who may have cast ballots without knowing they were still not legally permitted to do so. Almost all those targeted by the police force were Black and Democrats. In Georgia, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger announced another 191,000 people will be purged from Georgia election rolls, even though they're registered voters. The move targets voters who are deemed inactive because mailed election materials were not able to be delivered, and voters who may have not officially signaled an address change. Kendra Cotton, head of the New Georgia Project Action Fund, said, quote, Georgia is well known for its wide-ranging and creative attempts at voter suppression. Voting is a right. If someone chooses not to use it, that doesn't mean they lose it, they said. Meanwhile, in Alabama, lawmakers passed a new congressional map this week that still does not include a second majority Black district as ordered by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. In other news from Alabama, the state executed James Barber early this morning after the U.S. Supreme Court denied a request for a stay. It's the first execution by lethal injection in Alabama following a pause last year to review a series of botched executions. The group Reprieve said, quote, there's no humane method of execution. Executions aren't working, and it's torture, they said. A warning to our audience, the following story contains descriptions of sexual violence. In India, protesters have taken to the streets after a video went viral on social media showing dozens of men sexually assaulting two women in the northeastern state of Manipur. The incident took place in May, but the video surfaced just this week due to an internet ban in the region. The main suspect was arrested Thursday, accused of dragging the two women, aged 21 and 42, onto the street and inciting a mob of over two dozen men to assault them, then parade them on the streets naked. At least one of them was raped by the mob. Manipur has recently seen soaring ethnic violence between the majority Métis group and the tribal Kuki minority. The two women assaulted in the video are Kuki. The families of the two survivors have denounced police misconduct, saying it took law enforcement months to address the case. In Ecuador, some 1,200 barrels of crude oil spilled into the Pacific Ocean Wednesday, contaminating over 2 miles of shoreline. Officials with Ecuador's national oil company, Petroecuador, said a tank in a maritime terminal had surpassed its capacity, causing it to spill. The company was only able to contain about half the spilled crude, while the rest collected on the ocean front of the popular Las Palmas beach. Cleanup efforts are underway as environmentalists warn of the effects the spill could have on local wildlife. Here in New York City, lawyers, plaintiffs, and city officials held a news conference Thursday following the announcement the city will settle for $13 million with racial justice protesters who were brutalized by the New York police during the 2020 uprising that followed the murder of George Floyd. This is attorney Wiley Stecklow.
Today's settlement is historic, and I'm very proud that it will bring some sense of justice to nearly 1,400 people who took to the streets and put their bodies in the line against police brutality. But as a New York City taxpayer, I am bothered. The payout is a red flag, but we still have NYPD executive officers like Chief of Patrol John Chell, Inspector Elias Nikas, leading unconstitutional protest policing in this city. Their example to the rest of the 35,000 members of service is that the Constitution does not apply simply when these high-ranking members of the service say so.
The Senate Judiciary Committee advanced legislation to mandate the Supreme Court adopt a code of ethics and stricter financial disclosure rules. The move comes following explosive revelations around several justices, most notably Clarence Thomas, who was lavished for decades with luxury travel and gifts by GOP megadonor Harlan Crow. No Republicans voted for the measure, though they did attempt to add amendments to make it easier for judges to carry weapons and to ban reporters from publishing draft opinions without court approval. The amendments were defeated. And in labor news, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, has averted a strike that would have shut down Broadway after reaching a tentative deal to improve working conditions for some 1,500 stagehands, hair and makeup artists, and wardrobe personnel. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, we speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa on a new investigation into the sexual abuse of women detained by ICE. And then we speak to Isabel Allende about her new novel. Stay with us.
Broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and worldwide at ckut.ca. My name is Jules. Today on the program, we're bringing you this week's headlines, as well as coverage of a strike that has seen 1,700 casino workers on the picket line since June. Yesterday, I caught up with three striking workers, as well as their union spokesperson, at the CSN offices in Montreal. But first, here's what made news in Montreal this week. On Wednesday, the government of Quebec lifted all remaining mask mandates in the province. Officials cited the decrease in case rates and argued that most Quebec residents have some immunity from infection. While masking has been optional in most settings for several months, it will no longer be required, even for medical staff coming into contact with a patient who is COVID positive. Montrealers are still dealing with the fallout of last week's storm, when about 130 households flooded. The storm also flooded Resilience Montreal, a shelter in the Atwater neighborhood. They are asking the public for donations to help make up for around $10,000 in spoiled food, as well as tents, sleeping bags, shoes, and men's clothing. This past Monday, workers at the cemetery Notre-Dame-des-Neiges returned to work after a 7-month strike. Union members voted 83% in favor of the new collective agreement. Members of the public will be granted access to visit loved ones starting in September. This week saw the opening of the Maison de Chambre Rachel Frontenac. The development holds 28 new units of social housing for residents with mental health concerns. Rents are capped at 25% of residents' incomes, thanks to a rent supplement. Yet the province's approach to affordable housing is changing. Last month, Quebec's housing minister, France-Hélène Duranceau, announced that instead of constructing and administering social housing, the CAQ government will bring about new ways for nonprofits to buy and administer pre-existing buildings themselves through Bill 31. This signals a step back from social housing that has faced criticism during what advocates have called a housing crisis. A class action suit against the Archdiocese of Montreal has just been settled in Quebec's Superior Court. Victims of sexual abuse dating back to 1940 will be eligible for up to $160,000 and receive an apology letter from Archbishop Christian Lepine. Victims have until October 22nd to register for the settlement. Finally, two Montreal police officers are appealing a 22-day suspension from Quebec's police watchdog, the BEI. After arresting David Chetea-Kaloubi in 2017, officers Dominique Gagné and Mathieu Paré failed to disclose his sickle cell anemia to prison guards, though Kaloubi told them he needed his medication while in custody. He died the next day from a cardiac arrhythmia. The officers admit to lying to investigators, but say they were not told that their statements could be used against them. Last year, the Quebec Superior Court ruled that officers have the right to remain silent and are not even forced to submit a report when facing a BEI investigation. However, the ruling has not yet come into effect as it faces an appeal from the Quebec government. Quebec's police watchdog has been plagued with allegations of police favoritism and a lack of transparency since it was launched, with only a handful of its almost 200 investigations resulting in charges. Our top story today is the ongoing casino worker strike. Since late June, workers from the Montreal Casino, as well as three others in the province and in online gaming, have been on the picket lines. Their main ask is for salaries to be kept competitive and adjusted to inflation. Union spokesman Ricardo Scopoletti outlined all that and more in our interview on Thursday. Here he is.
I'm Rick Scopoletti. I am the representative for the Montreal Casinos on the union side with the CSN, which is the Canadian National Trades Union. We are representing all the casino workers across Quebec and the online gaming who have been on strike since the 22nd of June. Our revendications, if you will, basically is on salary, shift premiums, vacation time, and of course, new entry level employees with a major reduction in salary, which the employer wants to impose on us. So that's basically our quick story where we're at right now.
You spoke a bit about salary reductions. Can you tell me more about that? What is it that prompted the casino workers to go on strike last month?
Negotiations stopped pretty much around the 25th of May. We had seven meetings based on salary from February 21st, seven consecutive meetings on an average of one or two a week that brought us until May with a big difference. We had a conciliator named in the dossier. And the stumbling block is basically on salary. We're asking for a three-year contract, which is the inflation rate plus $1. For 2022, 23 inflation rate plus $1, and into 24, same principle. The inflation rate is 5.6% in the first year in 2022, and it's at 6.7% in the second year. The boss is countering with a 12.5 over 5 years, which is an average of 2.5%, which the numbers are way out of whack according to the industry. We're way behind in salary scale and shift premiums. It's also another big demand for us. Our core service is between Thursday and Sundays, which is either evenings and nights, and the staff are inadequately paid on those areas. When I say a salary reduction, since COVID, we've lost over 1,400 employees. It's still counting. We have a hard time drawing them to us and then keeping us with us. Their offer in the same offer of the 12.5%, the 2.5 ratio, is 10% less salary for new entry employees for the first year, which represents about $3 less an hour to draw somebody to a new career, which is totally absurd. You're not going to draw people with taking away, which has already been attained since past collective agreements. So this is something that's just unacceptable across the board to the new and to the older staff that are supporting them to say this is not right.
Yeah, so a lot of what we are hearing from Lotto Quebec in the public response that they have to the strike action, as well as the strike action by other casino workers that occurred last summer, they're saying that workers are paid around 20% above market rate. What is your response to that?
20% above market rate probably pertains about 10 to 12 years ago. We were above the salary scale. If you go out to any employer, which has been done in the last 24 to 30 months since COVID, we're in the same whack or well below when it comes to shift premium and starting out salary and top end salary, which is one of the areas where we said we have to get back up to par to put us back on the map where we once were. When we compare to the other union, which is the SCFP, the Croupier Union, that were on strike last year for 14 weeks, their offer and they accepted that was a deposit of a collective agreement that was given to them in 2019 till 2022, which ends at the end, the beginning of 2024. So in 11 months from now, they're back to the table. Their offers were based on when the inflation rate was at 0.8, 1.4, and 3.1 in 2022, just in that lip part. Their settlement was perfect for them because they were all on mise à pied. We opened and closed three times during that area from March 2020 until March 2022. So a lot of their payment got in terms of back time when you're on mise à pied, so there's no tax on it and so on. So it was a good deal for them. The playing field is totally different for us. The inflation rate is much higher. It's not at 0.8. It's at 5.6. It's at 6.7. And not to mention the same time when they deposited, this is going back 3 years ago. We're looking forward going to 227. So that's it's kind of like we're the locomotive and we're not the back part of the train. We're the front part.
And how have you seen working conditions change? What has changed, what hasn't changed since the start of the pandemic in 2020?
Many services are still closed as we speak in 2023. They were promised to be reopened, which never occurred. The other services that did open, they opened at half the staff that they used to be. So the staff is overworked. Sure, they're offering overtime, but you can only do so many hours in a week. At the same time, the area where they once worked, example, in the Unité Générale, if you were working at customer service, and because the counters are no longer as big as they used to be, there's not enough jobs there, so you have what we call a bumping, where you can go and bump by your entry seniority and bump somebody else. So we've had customer service representatives become cleaners in the cleaning department. Cleaners in the cleaning department have become in the vestiaire workers. So after being in those positions for 15, 20, 25 years and then being bumped back and then working with half the staff or having your department closed, again, it's another major irritant that we're trying to work on. I mean, we, in the post negotiations that we had with the employer, when I say post, everything on the normal clauses, anything that's scheduling and department opening and closings, we had some very good advancements, but it all attaches to the monetary advancement that goes with it. And that's where they're not stepping up because we're negotiating with the corporate and it's a bit different negotiations with them than it is with our direct bosses at the casino. It is a lot different.
So how have negotiations been going since this June 22nd strike? Have you guys been at the bargaining table? Any advances have been made? What's that conversation like?
Since May 25th, there's been no talks, no discussions, nothing official. There's been little communications with the conciliator each side week to week. We're going into our fifth week now. Basically, does anybody have anything different to say or whatnot? We're waiting for a response from the movement we made on the 9th and 10th of May, which we were together with the employer and the conciliator. We went on what we call a piste de travail, which is basically a working block, and we kind of divided the two areas in monetary and less monetary to try and provoke a negotiation. And on the 25th, we got the same answer, which was the same document that they deposed back on February 21st over the seven negotiation days that we had. the same offer. It was basically saying, this is your offer. We're not changing it. No matter what you present us, we're not moving. So there's been no movement since May 25th and very little discussion with the conciliator and so on in between parties. So nothing's moved.
You know, you guys were outside the Loto-Québec building on Sherbrooke recently. Tonight you'll be on the Pont Jacques-Cartier, the Jacques-Cartier Bridge. What do you have planned for the upcoming summer of strike actions? And what kind of strike actions have been happening?
Coming up, as you said, tonight, we're going to have a little march and a friendly march to the people. All our demonstrations are friendly. There's nothing aggressive. We're just trying to get our signal, our visibility into the public. We are in front of a lot of Quebec Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesdays. We have our weekly assemblies on Thursdays. And on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we're in front of the casino, which is just on Île Notre-Dame. We have national mobilization meetings, if you will, demonstrations with the other unions. Let's not forget our colleagues out in Mont-Tremblant, Charlevoix, and in Lac-Lemay in Gatineau. They're all part of this, and also online gaming, which are with us locally in Montreal. So it's a coordinated effort. Every 2-3 weeks, we are going to target all Loto-Québec installations, everything they fund, everything that they promote to get our message across to the people that come to them, which are most likely our customers, to say, hey, listen, we want to get back to work. You know, let's talk to the boss, put a little pressure on our side and get them back to the table. And once we get back to the table on 4 issues of salary, it's going to go rather quick. We want to get back and see our customers we've seen for the last 30 years. So that's our thing. But the target is going to be Loto-Québec and everything that they fund and promote. That's what we're going to look at over the summer.
And so far, what has the response been like from the general public?
I can honestly say general public on the picket line in front of Loto-Québec. Everybody comes by, they dance with us. We've got a variation of age groups with us, from young, from as little as 18 to 35, from 35 to 65. And at every level, they stop, they're asking, they're inquiring, tourists from out of town, locals in the office buildings adjacent to them, in front of them, beside them. Our customers on the picket line at the casino stop and have offered us money, brought us Tim Hortons, offered anything that they can do from there. And some of them even turn around and go home, not to support us, not and go and support the casino that day until we get back to work, which has been very positive. We've had no negative incidents that have occurred whatsoever. Some people are a little, not maybe happy with us out on the street, but they just walk around us with a little angry face and they keep going. So there's no conflict, but it's all been positive since.
So right now, and I guess in the past few years, in North America more broadly, but even currently in Canada, we've been seeing more and more strike actions influenced by changing work conditions during the COVID-19 pandemic. Where do you see this action fitting into this larger moment that we're in right now in the labor movement?
We're fortunate or unfortunate, because at the end of the pandemic, March 2022, things started opening up. And this is where we had a lot of promises from our bosses that things will be getting back to normal. And I wouldn't say COVID's fully forgotten, but it's in the distant past now. And we're still not even close to being back to what we were. Loto-Québec posted their best year yet last year in terms of profitability, over $2 billion in profits. And, where do we want to face on that? We would like to put our staff back to the level that we had it. The striking of terms of in Quebec alone, for I know from the CSN, it's one of the highest rates of strikes in the last 24 months than they've had in the last 6 years, which shows you something right there in the labor market. It's just the competitivity of salaries. An example, I have kids and I have grandchildren, and I have kids that have worked at McDonald's, and I have grandchildren working at McDonald's presently, and they've got shift premiums more than what I would make on a shift premium on a night shift. I don't want to compare the Montreal casino to McDonald's, but when they're better paid than us on a shift premium, you kind of have to say, that was my job growing up. I worked there for 4 years, but at the same time, it paid my education to get me through college. So it helped me out along the way. And we also have seasonal workers that are coming in and they want to take 10% away. So in terms of labor conflicts since COVID, it's been a major, major issue. Salaries being competitive or less competitive. People saw during the COVID that they can actually make money, and it doesn't have to be in a, you know, what we call a société d'état, which is a government-level job, because it's just competitive in the private sector now. So that's why people are, hey, even though I'm 30 or 40 or 50 years old, I can find something better, and which wasn't the case in our industry 10, 15 years ago. It was a job to keep, a job to stay, and it's just kind of, it's lost its luster.
That's especially true for workers like Ricardo Nucci, a 30-year veteran of the security department.
In terms of the money, we're really trying to keep up with inflation and just to keep our heads above water. We're not asking for the moon. We're not asking for everything. But with the numbers that Loto Quebec has given out, the amount of profits, that the big bosses have been getting, we would like our little share of the riches.
Nucci characterized the offer from management as a blow to long-term and newer workers alike.
This strike hurts me more than other strikes and lockouts have over the years. I feel I've given more than half of my life to the casino, and there's a lack of respect. We're a good number that have done 25 years and more, and we're still there, and it's like we're just a number. We're not respected, and I find that their offers are very, very slim and insulting, actually.
That's really been kind of what's really gone under people's skin. Being told that we're offering a fair deal, you guys are good, you guys are getting paid well, there's no worry. And then on the other hand, they're saying $1.6 billion profit was given to the government.
This is Constantinos Alexiou, a former cook in the casino who now works in online gaming. He says the disparity between management and workers is a huge motivating factor in the strike.
In terms of like just increases and everything. So it's kind of insulting to be told, hey, there's no money, but we'll give you, you know, we'll take this much bonus, but there's no money to give you guys, especially when they're asking newcomers to take a 10% hit on their salary. So it's not only us who are not getting the pay increase that would be a cost of living adjustment, but rather all newcomers are going to take 90% of the salary they should be getting in the first place. It's insulting. That's the only way I could say it.
Ricardo Nucci's daughter, Erica, who started working at the casino last December, agrees. She says that if things don't change, life in Montreal will become more and more unaffordable for casino workers.
Truthfully, we're the ones who are bringing in any sort of revenue at this point. And then to be told that they want to give us an average of 2.5% for the next 5 years, when we know inflation is a lot higher than that, it is pretty discouraging. And they want to lower salaries already. That seems kind of unfair, especially looking at rent around Montreal even. I was looking to move out, and now I cannot afford to, especially with a strike. And even if they had lowered my salary, I don't think I would have been able to afford it, seeing how these rents are so high.
Almost a month into the strike, spirits are still high on the picket line, but that doesn't mean there's no worry. The salary negotiations will affect people's livelihoods, their families, and their homes in Montreal.
There's definitely a lot of anxiety because obviously a lot of people here in the casino, both spouses work together. If they're both on strike, that's two salaries off the table. And we're not getting very much for the amount of striking that we do have to do every week. So for sure, there's a lot of anxiety. Some of them are angry, rightfully so. Some of them were planning to retire and now have to push it back by a few years. Anyone who had recently made big purchases, now they don't know if they can even afford these new purchases, because how are they supposed to pay it when they're not being paid a salary that they were expected to have? As for the public, when we are at the casino, our clients are all honking, giving us a thumbs up, you know, clapping, big smiles, but they still go in. They keep going in and they keep spending money. And even the ones who stop by the side of the road and they know us and they tell us, oh, we support you, we're not spending money, but we see them every single day. They go back. They're the regulars. They're going to keep coming in no matter what, even though they don't have the restaurant, they don't have the service. And we know when we come back, they'll be telling us they didn't go, they're supporting us, but we all know that wasn't true.
That's why Ricardo Scopoletti has one message for listeners, and that's boycott.
Basically, you know, of course, we're putting money into Lotto Quebec's pocket. Boycott the casinos, boycott lottery tickets, boycott anything pertaining to online gambling would help us out immensely. The moment the profits go down, history shown in the past, because this is our third time in 30 years having to go strike to prove a point. And once they see their profits going down, that's when they react to negotiations and they come with substantial offers to move the negotiations and to solve the problem. We're hoping it's going to be very short and it's going to happen soon. If they can support us in any way, that would be one. When they see us on a picket line or in a visibility somewhere, just support us, put up with, if it's a slowdown in traffic or if we're blocking your sidewalk, walk around us, stop and chat with us. We're the friendliest people ever. We work in customer service all our lives, so that's what we want to do. We're not aggressive. We never will be, but I would say boycott Lotto Quebec and any other fundings until this thing gets solved. That would be a great help to us.
Following a request for comment, Lotto Quebec sent me this statement. Quote, Lotto Quebec is disappointed with the union's decision to continue with an unlimited general strike, considering that all the components needed to reach an agreement are available. The employer has tabled a generous, comprehensive monetary offer. The corporation is determined to propose significant improvements to working conditions while ensuring that public funds are managed soundly. You can read the rest of that statement online as part of their July 5th press release on the Lotto Quebec website. This is Jules Bigel, and you've been listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. Thanks so much.
These ends. That's if these ends curved. A circle. miles in circumference. Make the island crescent-shaped like an earring. Thank you.
Thank you. Bonsoir à tous et bienvenue sur Café, votre émission d'art et culture du vendredi. Ici Esther Bourdage avec vous pour une heure de café. Donc j'espère que vous allez bien. Aujourd'hui, bien, je débute la couverture officielle du Festival Fantasia, festival international qui réunit des films de tous les coins de la planète, des films de genre, et des films de genre, bien, on peut développer sur ce